Maybe they're all chanting requests. I don't have to answer any questions. I was just reading a talk of Ajahn Chah's. He mentions vipassana. Could you explain this more? Of course, vipassana is insight, but then vipassana is kind of a slang or idiom. What it is it's like there's what's called vipassanupakilesa, which are the defilements of insight. So then, rather than practicing vipassana, people practice vipassanu, sort of hone those defilements of insight. Dear Lumpa, your generosity is inspiring. I was recently listening to an Abhayagiri Dhamma talk given by a visiting Ajahn. He spoke of you receiving an honor. I couldn't quite understand what he meant. Would you elaborate on what it was, who bestows it, and what it means for you and the community? Thank you. It's from Thailand, and it's called a Jao Kun title, which is it's like a ecclesiastical title that's given by the king. And usually it's given to monks who've done a lot of service for, oftentimes it's in administrative or, sometimes forest monks will get, receive that title. Rare, but sometimes, because we tend to be outside of the loop of administration, titles, all of that, and so that from time to time a forest monk's will recite Ajahn Chah was given that title, and it's given by the king. It's actually Ajahn Amar and I are both receiving that title, so it's quite special. First time that two Westerners have ever received a title. There's only four Westerners who've received this title, so it's pretty rare. It's an honor, when the retreat ends, then it's on the king. It's given on the king's birthday, December 5th, so that I'll be flying to Thailand on the 2nd. So go back to Abhayagiri, spend a day, go back down to do First Tuesday in Berkeley, and then get on the plane the next morning to Thailand. And so there's, on a certain level, this doesn't mean much, but it's a big deal. So there's a lot of people in Thailand who are very excited, because in terms of what's it mean for myself and the community, probably means that the Thai Sangha will try to find ways to make me work harder. I've tried to sort of keep out of, just keep up in Northern California and not to get too engaged. But it does have a how do you say? There's a certain how do you say? It's like a stamp of approval. Okay, these Westerners are doing something good in the West, and that's so it's like an official stamp of approval, which is a good thing. So that's a very beneficial thing that comes from that. But it will be. And I think there's a certain amount of there's one of the monks in England, senior monks, was sort of grumbling and complaining of it was very interesting. Ajahn Amaro, this exchange took place with Ajahn Amaro in it. And he's kind of grumbling and complaining. There's just titles, and that's really not forest monk stuff. And then they're going on talking about something else, and then that senior monk expressed some concern of a monk in Thailand who had heard rumors that he was kind of trying to gain more, authority in the Wat Pa Pong Sangha, so that he sort of set himself up to hopefully be the abbot after Ajahn Liam, and he was sort of complaining. One, it's just a lot of projection and worry. But then Ajahn Amaro said, you know, now that Ajahn Pasona and I'll have Jao Kun titles, you know, our voices will carry a lot more weight in our sangha. He said, "Oh yeah, well maybe that's a good thing." So it's a flip flop back and forth. Okay, great gratitude to each of you for inspiring teachings and the gift of your presence. Could you talk a bit about kilesas, how to see them clearly and work with them skillfully without falling into discouragement and self-judgment? A bow of gratitude. I think on broad brush, kilesas are defilements or stains of the mind. Typically, or most fundamentally, greed, hatred, and delusion, those are the roots. It's actually called Yamula Kilesa, the kind of root defilements. One can parse it out in many different ways, just as I said, like the Vipassanupa Kilesas, which are defilements of insight, which are more refined aspects of how defilements manifest themselves. I think one of the things in terms of particular defilement, obstruction that we're experiencing, the practice itself and our attention to our actions of body, speech, and mind, cultivation of one of the terms that Ajahn Chah and most of the forest teachers talk about of what we cultivate is mindfulness and discernment. It's mindfulness and discernment. You hear it over and over again of what we. What our cultivation is giving us, and that gives us a clarity and a reflective quality that we can be attentive to The things that are obstructions, but then also the wholesome qualities that we can cultivate. So I think a lot of it is the dealing with it skillfully, without falling into discouragement and self-judgment, is to recognize that discouragement and self-judgment are defilements, and they're obstructions that can be seen and understood and relinquished, the same as anything else. So that there, it gives us a perspective, because you can. It's easy to build up a self-perception of just being overwhelmed and completely loaded up with all sorts of defilements and kilesas, and forget, well, that's a small part of the picture, really. I mean, one wouldn't even take interest in meditation practice, spiritual practice, Buddhist practice, if that were really the case. Wholesome qualities, and we tend not to direct attention to our wholesome qualities. We tend to overlook them, and that's actually a practice that is helpful in terms of reflecting on a daily basis. Okay, what were the occasions when a particular defilement overwhelmed one? What did it do to overcome that? But then, in the same part of the reflection, what wholesome things did we do to make that very conscious? What wholesome things did we do? Where did we help? Where did we do? And then also, what wholesome things did we see in others? So then, because it's again, it's a whole realm of self-judgment. You keep coming up short. So that, to consciously start to pay attention. What were the actual defilements that were manifesting? But then also, what actual wholesome things did one do? And then what wholesome things did one recognize in others that one delighted in? So then it starts shifting perception. The perception starts to change. Oh, Paul, can you repeat the Thai words for "is it worth it" that you mentioned this morning? I'd like to use it as a mantra. It's a great mantra. Mai is like the question mark at the end of the word, and then kum, is it worth it? Kum mai, is it worth it? That's a great mantra. Are there any suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya that you recommend lay people study? I'm familiar with 9, 10, 27. And through it. Well, I'd recommend 1 through 152. Those are really good ones. The Majjhima Nikaya is a great a collection of teachings, because it really gives it lays out the broad spectrum of the Buddha's teaching, both to lay people to monastics, both in terms of skillful conduct as well as realization. So it's an excellent collection. Dunupal, of course I have a good dose of all the hindrances, but I think restlessness is my middle name. Can you please give me some ideas for antidotes? So far, the best I have is to give myself a set time and not move one iota from sitting or standing. Another is to not fight it, but use it for imaginative contemplation, to put it to good use. Any other suggestions? Thank you so much for the Dhamma treasures of this week. Yeah, I think one is I mean, those are good in the sense of setting a determination, because what it does is also developing, I think the word barami is wholesome character traits or wholesome qualities, like Ajahn Yaniko spoke in his talk this afternoon of Kanti Barami, so developing the Barami of patience or steadfastness. And Adhidhana Barami is the Barami. And Barami is, as a word, its literal meaning is that which crosses over. So it's like these wholesome qualities that help to carry the mind over. In terms of its wholesome qualities. So that Adhidhana Barami is a resolution. Training oneself, and one of the things of cultivating resolution and Adhidhana is to make resolutions that you know you can keep, so that you get you build confidence in it, rather than all of a sudden get inspired or fed up with I'm tired of this restlessness. Okay, I'm not going to move for 6 hours, and it's just way beyond what you could possibly do. So then you quit somewhere in halfway, and then beat yourself up because you didn't do it. So that building up a confidence with just taking it in small chunks, and then you make those resolutions, and then you build skill and confidence, and be like, okay, I can stick with that. And then you also start seeing the benefit that comes from it. It feels really good when I stick with that, and then you gain the confidence. So that setting determinations, and also in terms of, especially in terms of meditation, that if one has a restless nature, learning how to channel it, so that imaginative contemplation is it's important to be able to apply that energy, because it's the thinking process is not necessarily a problem for practice. If we direct the thinking towards investigation or recollection of a Buddha Dhamma Sangha, recollection of particular teachings, recollection of themes of generosity or loving kindness, and it's the continuity of wholesome mental states that allows the mind to become settled and steady. It's not because you've decided to force your mind on a particular object that it's going to actually be peaceful. Because sometimes you can force the mind to stop thinking. It doesn't mean you're happy or even peaceful. It's just that you've managed to squelch the thinking mind for a bit, but usually it's just like a spring that's just waiting to explode out. So that learning how to channel that thinking and the mental energy into something that's really, say, uplifting and inspiring to the mind. Another aspect of application of, say, directing attention to the body, learning how to relax the body, learning how to calm the body. That's it, using the breath to calm the body, using the breath to calm the. Because sometimes that's like it's the body and mind are so interwoven if we pay attention to to how to settle and soothe and relax the body, the mind will settle. There's a really common anti-anxiety drug that. What's the most common one?
Valium.
Valium, yeah. Valium is a muscle relaxant. It's not. That's what its actual function. So, but its other effect is that it settles. Why is the Buddha referred to in the present tense in the chants? Is it because we're referring to the present potential within us? Yeah, that's an interesting observation, because that's when we take the Buddha as refuge, we're not. Part of the refuge is historical, but that's history. But it's the Buddha principle, the principle of awakening, the principle of being the one who knows, that we take as a refuge, so that in the chants, it's not looking to a historical Buddha, but looking to the Buddha as a presence and potential within us at any time that we draw close to the. Ajahn Chah used to emphasize that a lot, that when we take refuge and when we reflect on the Buddha, this is something that we're doing in our hearts and learning how to nourish that quality of awakening of enlightenment within us. When bowing three times, do you say something in your mind, like taking refuge or anything else? It depends. I think it's something that one can experiment with and work with. I tend to Just come back to the physical sensations, or just getting, being mindful, being present, grounding myself in awareness. But I think with the experimenting and seeing, well, what actually does help the mind come together? What helps to inspire them? Because sometimes that, like in the Thai language or in the Thai tradition, they'll use a recitation of say just Buddha, and they'll do that as a meditation object of its own, just a recitation Buddha. They'll use it in conjunction with a breath. So on the in-breath, put, the out-breath, to, put, to. But one can do that when one's bowing. Bowing, put, to, dhammo, sangho. So that's a recollection of the refuges. So a lot of it is just experimenting and seeing what helps to make it relevant. This follows on from last night of the Dhamma stuff available. So I think it'd be great if you have video clips uploaded to YouTube. Your teaching is great and easy to follow. This can be a good source for other people to learn Dhamma. There are very few Theravada teachings in English on YouTube. Maybe when we get our new hall, that's part of the. We're in the process of building a new meditation hall, reception hall. And it will have the capacity to for sound and video, so that might. We'll see what happens, but well, at least we'll have the capacity. Can you? There's a bunch of things here. Can you say more about trusting the seeds of meditation practice after Alzheimer's dementia kicks in? Second, what do you mean with going beyond liberation or consciousness? What do you mean with, quote-unquote, many deeper layers are affected by the practice and the fruits of it will express naturally? Is this getting too esoteric? So it's like when we... when we've done the practice, the transformation of the mind, the heart, is like something like Alzheimer's, dementia. Definitely affects the cognitive functioning, executive functions, but the kind of inner well-being may not be, doesn't have to be affected. Of course, a great example is Ajahn Chah himself. He had a degenerative brain disease that left him without a faculty, motor capacity, speech, and. But he was a delight to be around. And remember one time, in the early years of him being ill. There was a monk who was he's well known for his psychic abilities and ability to track other people's mind, mental states. And he'd heard that Ajahn Chah was ill, and so he came to visit. And and he dropped into meditation, sort of investigated what, say, the state of Ajahn Chah's mind, and then after he came and talked to us, and said, how did he put it? He said, "Oh, you don't have to worry about Ajahn Chah." He says, "You should keep worrying about yourselves." And he said, his mind is just so bright. But it was interesting. One of the things he also said is that, you know, his inclination is that he likes to contemplate dependent arising, dependent origination, and so it'd be really helpful for you to, or for him, if you chanted that for him from time to time. And so it was in the early years when I became the abbot of Wat Nanachat. So after that, then I started taking our community over to Wat Bapong, at Ajahn Chah's monastery, and we'd do chanting for him, which would include dependent origination. And you know, he probably benefited, but I think we certainly benefit from that opportunity to do that for him. So that, you know, it was a sort of every week we'd pile people into various vehicles and go over and chant and meditate with outside of Ajahn Chah's nursing kuti, as his dwelling that day we're looking after Ajahn Chah with. What do you mean by with going beyond liberation or consciousness? I don't know that I said going beyond liberation. Certainly one has to go beyond consciousness, in the sense that one is just seeing the limitation, and stepping out beyond the... because I think it was probably in reference to the phrase that Ajahn Chah used, beyond, say, outside of birth, beyond death, outside of cause, beyond effect, outside of... So that, you know, realizing, yeah, you, the things that we set up as concepts, whether it's concerning... ourselves, the world around us, the Buddhist teachings, ideas of the mind, all of those are concepts, and we have to step beyond them. And we have to realize the limitation that we set by that. So that comes back to relinquishment. Just that, it's something else to put down, in the sense of, because we tend to carry them as burdens. And that, but of course, when I say as we do that, the more willing we are to relinquish, the more willing we are to become awake and present with our experience, then different aspects of ourselves starts to simplify, become clearer, the fruits of the practice will start appearing quite naturally. You don't have to force that or try to gain some kind of realization, like it's written in the books, and try to line yourself up with the stages in the Visuddhimagga. It's all sort of, it gets all formulaic, and it becomes conceptual. These are the fruits of practice arise through that, just this simple quality of being the one who knows, and this quality and taking the Buddha as refuge, being the one who knows, being one who is awakened, being one who is radiant, allowing those qualities to establish themselves within the heart. And that it's that which is our kind of our guide or our inspiration as we even as we struggle with the precepts or we struggle with our meditation object. But as we keep returning to that, things keep falling away. The practice becomes more clear. Thanks for your teaching on, quote, look for something interesting, unquote. I'm curious, after 40 years of meditating, what do you find that is still interesting? I find the breath really interesting. I find things that are allow the mind to brighten, and I find that really interesting. I find the teachings that the Buddha gave, way more interesting than when I first started practicing. I didn't understand it then. So that as they become more clear, the teachings they seem to open up into such wonderful insights into truth and reality. So it's even more interesting as we continue to practice. It's one of the things of, in terms of, I remember as a layperson, either studying at university or traveling around the world or doing whatever, I was just bored. But practicing Dhamma, sometimes it's difficult, but it's always interesting. I'm so grateful for the peace I am developing here and in my life. It feels like a refuge. Is it the fourth refuge? Thank you so much. I think one of the things is, just stick with three, you'll be okay. It's enough. It's just one more. Just give me more. But as you realize that those three refuges are the nature of, say, the nature of the Buddha is peace. The nature of Dhamma is peace. These are you look at the, say, the archetype of the Buddha. There's a good image there, where that's a really peaceful image, and it's a very peaceful recollection, some peaceful reminder. So so the Buddha, the teachings of the Dhamma, lead us to peace. I just remember one time, the very first time that Ajahn Sumedho went back to Thailand to visit Ajahn Chah and visit Wat Pa Pong. He'd been in England for 5 years, and so then he was coming back to Thailand for the first time and pay respects to Ajahn Chah, and one of the English students at the monastery there had wanted to give Ajahn Sumedho a gift to take to Ajahn Chah. So he sculpted a Buddha image, and it was his first attempt at doing a Buddha image, and it had a kind of a stiff quality to it, sitting upright. I mean, it's this really serious meditator, really kind of upright. And so anyway, Ajahn Sumedho brought it and made the offering, said where it was from, and set, Ajahn Chah set it on a table there, and he was talking and chatting, and he looked over there from time to time, and you get this smile on his face, and in the Thai language, a Westerner is a furong, and so that it was just. But anyway, then Ajahn Chah finally, because he couldn't hold it in any longer, he says, that Furong Buddha is really like a Furong. He's really tense and stressed. That was hilarious. Okay. You talk on relinquishing stuck a deep chord with me. Several months ago, I started to use the phrase, I'd rather be loved than right. This small shift has had a tremendous impact in my life as I relinquish my need to be right, to control, and to assert my ego into things. Thank you. I mean, that's the degree of conflict and burden that is sort of distributed around just in order to be right. It's real painful. So that, and that's something that I think the one of the say strong characteristics, I think particularly Westerners in general, Americans in particular, there's actually a very strong idealism, and sometimes it's to people's advantage, but that idealism is something that comes back and bites us. So that to that drive to be right, to fulfill the ideal, can be an incredible burden, tremendous suffering, and it tends to be tends to block out all sorts of areas of human contact or human relationships. I'll come back to again another Winnie the Pooh story. There was an occasion when Winnie the Pooh and Piglet went to visit Rabbit, and they visited and spent some time and had some conversation, and they kept waiting for Rabbit to see if they wanted something to eat, if there wasn't any sort of little smackerel of something in the in the cupboard. A bit of, Rabbit usually keeps some honey around somewhere. But anyway, Rabbit never offered anything, and so they talked, and then conversation petered out. So then they left. And then they're walking along, Pooh and Piglet together. And Pooh says, "Rabbit's clever, capital C." And Piglet said, "Well, yes." Pooh says, "And Rabbit has brain, capital B." And Piglet said, "Yeah." So, maybe that's why he never understands anything. There was a note to Ajahn Kurundamo to explain about the award Dylan Paul will be receiving, but already did it. So. How important is chanting for one's practice? Do you have any tips for how to recite / remember the Pali chants? A lot of it is say one's own feeling because some people feel attracted to chanting, or some people find it useful. I think one of the, as a monastic, then it's a part of the rhythm. We chant, we keep things neat and tidy, we eat. We sleep. It's just part of the rhythm of daily life, and so that it does give another avenue of application of effort, of establishing of mindfulness, of planting the seeds for reflection and contemplation, so that something that you've chanted over and over will start coming back to you later. Those are oftentimes things that pop up in the mind, and there'll be reflections will come around it. Sometimes it's that's where it's helpful to like the chanting in English as well as in Pali. It's a devotional practice, but then it's also it has these aspects of application of effort, application of mindfulness. It's something that prepares the mind for sitting, so that oftentimes we think of these say forest monks in Thailand just meditating out in the forest and austere, but oftentimes one of the things they're doing a lot of chanting. Like Ajahn Mun, that was in the evening time before he would start meditating, he'd usually chant for about an hour and a half, and then start meditating. It was a daily practice. One of the chants that he would recite on a daily basis would be the Girimananda Sutta. I mentioned it. It's these 10 recollections. Sometimes learning the chants. There's some of the phrases have a lot of key concepts that are helpful in practice. So that, say, like the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, there's some key elements of Buddhist practice and Buddhist wisdom investigation are embedded in the chant, so that those are helpful to learn or remember and bring to mind, or they come up spontaneously. So it opens up another avenue, especially when you're thinking of practice as a long-term project, and then having different tools that you can be applying effort and then attention with, and then different people. Well, like right now, there's one of the novices at Abhayagiri. Gosh, I don't know how many hours a day he chants, but it's a lot. And he's a he does a lot of meditation as well. But he's found that the chanting's really helpful. One of the monks who's gone to Thai went last year, Kovilo. He's staying at a monastery, particularly because they do the evening meditation session is 3 hours of chanting and then a 3 hour sit. that's the evening program. and he likes the chanting, he doesn't like the sitting. But he's learning. That was one of the things I tasked him. I said, it's the thing you need to learn. But so there's many ways that it can be used. And then for some people, it never really takes root. So that, but I think one of the things I say coming on a monastic retreat is just sort of saying, oh, that's something as well. And seeing, oh, because it's always helpful to, you know, add a sort of another tool to your tool belt. That's the, you never know when you get to use it. In terms of, say, being tips for reciting and remembering, for reciting, especially if you're on your own, having the audio that you chant with is very helpful. Otherwise, you tend to make up the pronunciations on your own. And because the Pali actually has the structure of the language has its own rhythm to it, so that so that, yeah, being able to chant along to it, and you just become familiar with it. One of the things that most of us do or have done in learning chanting is be part of our walking meditation, so that picking up. You're doing walking meditation, and then learning the chant. So, in Thailand, when as a young monk, learning a lot of chants on alms round. You're walking on alms round, walking through the countryside, and phrase by phrase, you keep repeating it, and it sticks. So that you're incorporating it into. There's a certain sense of it becoming a tactile memorization as well. It's not just a cerebral thing. You do it while you're walking. And then just the doing of it over and over again helps the mind to... But it is an exercise in mindfulness as well. That's actually one of the definitions, or the most common definition of mindfulness, is that, one with mindfulness remembers things that they've committed to memory, things that have happened, we can be using it as a focal point for establishing our mindfulness. Okay, we're going to have a break and come back for chanting.